Welcome to Tea Talk, where athletes share their stories. Join us as we explore the profound connections between sports, community, and the human experience.
Hello, everybody. Can y'all hear me? Good morning.
Good morning, Kim.
Good morning.
Can you hear us?
All right, we're going to get started. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Carmen Jones, A.B. Freeman Business School, 1990, women's basketball, track and field, tea club, and I just want to thank and welcome all of you for coming out this morning to our podcast. It's actually on a link that's going out live, so your friends and family that do have the link are watching, so people are actually texting us, talking about how awesome it is right now to be able to see you guys. So we definitely want to thank everybody for coming out. And this is just part of Black Alumni Weekend, but also moving forward, this is part of Tea Club. And for all of you that are former athletes, you're all part of Tea Club. And what we are doing right now is we are trying to archive our stories. And then this was just the perfect opportunity for us to begin with Black Alumni Weekend and the integration of sports. So this is part one. So if you have some stories that you're interested in telling that you know that we don't quite get to today, just let me know and we'll be more than happy to get with you guys and archive your stories, because we want to get as many people involved as possible. But again, this is just the beginning. So with that being said, today's part one is going to be moderated by a man that maybe doesn't need an introduction, especially to any of you, but we're going to introduce him anyway. We're here talking about FIRST, and he was actually the first African-American sportscaster in this region. He's part of the Hall of Fame. He's won numerous awards, and he has had an impact on most of our lives, whether you know it or not. Most of you do know it, but most of you may not know the impact that he's had with bringing, I know, women's sports, high school sports, just all sports in New Orleans and in the region. So we are delighted to have him here today. I like to call him the icon. It's Mr. Roe Brown. So I'm going to turn it over to Roe.
Thank you. Icon means you're old. That's all it means. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Great to have y'all here. Thank you for having me here. No, I am not a Tulane grad. I went to school next door, Loyola, who are, our football team has been undefeated since 1939. Tulane can't say that. I don't care what y'all did the last 2 years, okay? Cotton Bowl and all that. That undefeated since 1939, so I'll stand by that. First of all, this is really a terrific thing that Carmen and Jim and all the people have put together here. So, you know, I'm the least important person in all of this, and so I want to get to introducing the people who really matter and do that really quickly. Most of you already know some of these people. I'll go with the people who are here sitting at the table first. This gentleman right here was an All-American football player at Tulane, 1972, 73, 74, right, from Lake Charles, Louisiana, Marion High School. All that good stuff. Hard to block. Number 79 in your program, number one in your hearts, Charlie Hall. This next guy blocked a lot of people the last 4 years. He is the current person. He's the baby of this group. So, I just introduce him in the middle of everybody else. And All-American, I call him an All-American, and obviously a all-conference player here and a terrific player and somebody who's going to be playing on Sundays, making a little money starting next year. And on top of that, having talked to him and interviewed him a couple times, he is probably the quintessential student athlete. and has one of the best names in all of college football, Sincere Haynesworth.
Thank you.
I'm going to skip because I kind of want to do the next person. We got some people who are on Zoom. And I should mention one of those people who is on Zoom was also 72, 73, 74, Letterman, one of Charlie Hall's teammates. They came here. You guys came the same time. Same time, same year and all that. He came from Garland, Texas. Number 23 in the program, as I recall, was a defensive back, a cornerback. I think he could correct me. I think he was drafted by the Rams, if I remember. But by Zoom, welcome. Big round of applause for John Washington.
Good morning. Good morning.
Full disclosure, the next person is somebody that I've been very close to for about 45 years. I'll just tell you up front. She was an all-state basketball player at Grace King High School here in New Orleans and was the first African-American female to get an athletic scholarship at Tulane University, Sharon Hill.
Good morning.
I'll come back here to the table, and the very first African-American athlete at Tulane University came here in, well, he graduated from high school in 1964, so I guess he came here in 64-65, was a baseball player. The first African-American athlete really in the Southeastern Conference. Most people think it was Perry Wallace, and I can understand why Perry Wallace at Vanderbilt, but actually, before Tulane got out of the SEC, this guy played a baseball game there. So to me, he's the first black athlete in the Southeastern Conference. And Steve Martin passed away about a decade ago or so. Terrific guy, terrific athlete, four-sport athlete at his high school, St. Augustine, when he got out of high school. Representing Steve here is the best person to represent Steve Martin, Steve Martin Jr. Once again, full disclosure, the next person I've known too long and known too well, and he was the first African-American athlete to get a scholarship here at Tulane University, highly recruited out of high school at St. Augustine High School, came here to Tulane and, well, just did an outstanding job. And you know he's gone on to do things professionally in the entertainment industry as an actor and a writer, producer, the whole works. And no, you may not see him a lot on screen, but he is far from retired. How about a round of applause for Mr. Harold Sylvester? All right, I didn't miss anybody, Carmen, huh? I got everybody? Okay, I got everybody, okay. So I left him for last because we have a video that Harold has produced that I think everybody needs to see. Harold, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Ro. How are you?
How you doing?
Good, man. You sound good. Hello to everybody.
Yep, yep. Well, should we just go right to your video? Is there anything you want to say a little bit before we get to it?
Straight to video is perfect.
Roll the videotape.
Mr. Sylvester's copyrighted video has been removed, but included is a brief excerpt.
I should have told this story a long time ago. I've been waiting for certain people to die, I guess. But I'm telling it now. 50 years later, the time seems just right. This is a story that I think needs to be told from both ends, then and now. The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Okay, I got two questions, Harold, that probably don't mean anything. Yeah. Was that Martin Luther King sitting on that pool table? It sure did look like him.
I don't recall.
Okay, but it sure did look like him. Just curious. And the other is, when is a movie coming out? Most of that stuff I never even heard.
Well, yes. Yeah, with the help of the entire Tulane community, maybe we can get it done.
No, I mean, the story is on you and some of that stuff you mentioned there. We kind of combined, you know, I guess, you know, I'll take the liberty here, you know. Steve Martin Jr. sitting here, and we kind of have both of your stories together because, you know, you guys were really first and there's some parallels, the whole works, and of course Steve's son can give all kinds of perspective, and you can give perspective also, because you know you knew him and was really kind of in the same time.
Right.
Steve got out of high school in 64, you got out in 67, but still, you know, same high school, and you kind of knew each other. So, you know, you've kind of told a little bit of your story right there. I mean, there's a lot more to it. So I'm going to go to Steve Martin Jr.
Before you go to Steve Rowe, yeah, I mean, let me bring you up to the Steve Martin Sr. that I knew.
Uh-huh.
Because essentially we came from the same place. You know, Steve was a senior at St. Aug when I was a freshman. Mm-hmm. I was a big fan of him.
Me too.
All that time, and we were friends through, because he also played basketball above my head. I was a freshman while he was a senior. And those of us who are older, you remember that freshmen were not eligible back in the day. So we actually never played together as teammates. But I got to observe him in all four sports. Thing about Steve Martin, you know, that always resonates with me, that I always remember, is that when he got to college, or was steered to college, as I like to think about it, because I think we all were to some extent at some point, he did not get placed in his best sport. You know, it was a big sacrifice for Steve Martin to go to Tulane in the segregated South, you know, when he could possibly have been at Michigan or Michigan State. You know, as the brilliant running back that he was, in high school. I think at the start of that, there's no tragedy. You know, Steve Martin was an incredibly successful human being. If there was any minimal tragedy, was that he did not get to play his best sport, you know, in college as a result of the times. I just want to say a few things about him. Yeah. I've never met a person, you know, with more profound sense of character, possessed of a more profound sense of character, you know, and brilliance at the same time, combined, you know, with tremendous, tremendous athletic talent. You know, he was the best running back I ever saw in high school. You know, he was the best in the state, you know, and why he could not, you know, I mean, move on, you know, to a university that was close to home, you know, where his parents could see him and play, you know, the sport that I thought is most talented in is the tragedy. Again, is the only tragedy. But he had a wonderful life, wonderful family, wonderful career. And as you tell when you hear from Stephen, he was a brilliant man. You know, with a deep heart, and so who suffered a lot of pain. You know, again, as a result of the experience. I know the Steve Martin that was, you know, the first ever African-American to play in the Southeastern Conference. But, you know, the better I know the Steve Martin, that was a kind of the ultimate human being. Whatever sadness, you know, we can derive, I mean, you from that story, I think people ought to pay attention to, because it really is kind of the tragedy of the times, you know, that I hope we're on our way to, you know, to correcting right now.
He was an all-around athlete. You don't need me to tell you that about your dad. He played all four sports when he was in high school. And I guess football, you know, the thing I remember, one of my favorite high school football games I ever attended, 13-12 state playoffs in 1963, St. Aug beat Booker T or Shreveport. And Steve knocked down, he was playing defense. He was playing both ways a lot of times. He knocked down what would have been a winning touchdown for Booker T, Washington, or Shreveport. But the thing about it also is that Steve Martin would have been at Tulane even if he didn't play football. Or he could have been, because he was that good of a student athlete. What about you, Steve Jr., when you think of your dad and what he did?
As Harold alluded to, that I think the end of his story in terms of knowing him as a human being is the most important part. But the beginning of his story, and for all of our athletes here that came to Tulane, his story is complicated. He was a part of a program at that time period when St. Augustine was leading a lot of integration, both with its athletic program, but also academically. The Josephite priests at that time were instrumental in placing black students around the country, Yale, Harvard, et cetera. And my dad's story, how he ended up at Tulane, is complicated and rather long, but I'll just shorten it and just say some of the highlights, which were one, he was, I won't say recruited to Tulane, but he was steered to Tulane. In the recruiting letters that he did receive, they were held back by the principal and weren't were given to him until actually the graduation day from St. Augustine High School. So he ended here at Tulane. He did not, at that time period, there were no athletic scholarships to Negroes during that time period. And so he came to Tulane on an academic scholarship from the Rockefellers. And I didn't study Latin, but somehow he ended up studying Latin and playing sports here at Tulane. That's another long story that I'm still trying to figure out Latin at that time period. But here, he was asked to walk on to Tulane. Actually, they started the conversation walking on to the football team. And the idea here and the strategy at that time period, and I have to use I have to use general terms because I'm not trying to intentionally call the administration or the athletic department out because there are a lot of figures moving through this time period. But the idea here was that if Steve Martin made the team as a walk-on, look how, quote-unquote, look how great this Negro was. And if Steve Martin did not make the team, well, he was a walk-on. That was the strategy. But then he had a meeting with a coach, with Coach Ben Abbey, and my grandfather. And the reason the decision was made for him not to try out for the football team was mainly at that time period was that the thought was that he would get killed. Because at that time period, as a running back, if you got tackled in the line, you would not, you couldn't see the knife coming, as my father would recommend, that something could happen in the huddle or the tackle. But ironically, and I'll stop here, is that when he goes out, gets on the baseball team, goes out and becomes an outfielder. So the very thing of him not playing or not going out for the football team, being in the outfield by himself in Oxford, in Starkville, well, the Klan would line up in the backfield along there, and they would mess with him, and they would threaten him. So on one side, the decision by my grandfather and him to not go out for football and thinking that baseball was going to be safer was not safer. So that's a little bit of how that part, how he came to Tulane on academic scholarship. He played as a first athlete in 1964, actually freshman as an LSU in baseball, and then the varsity team later on to become the to play varsity sport in the SEC. And let me stop there. That starts us.
You know, there's a little precedent to some of the things you mentioned. I just want to interject that, if I might. There was precedent to what their fear that they had, because if you ever go to Iowa State University, the stadium is named after a guy named Jack Trice. He was an African-American who played football at Iowa State in 1918. He played one game because the University of Minnesota killed him. Literally, I mean, he died a few days later from the injuries he sustained that were given to him purposely. And another thing, just because you talk about these things, Steve, and they come pop into my mind, I talked to one of your father's teammates one time. No one called his name. Good guy. And this was after your father's death, and I'd never heard this before, but this gentleman told me, he said that Steve was such a good guy, and he said, when we played in Starkville, I think he said, against Mississippi State, he would get all of these phone calls, obviously, threatening phone calls at the hotel room and everything. And this teammate told me that the other teammate told him, that was some of our guys making those phone calls, don't you? And he said, no, I didn't know that. He said, yes, it was. So when you talk about what you had to go through there, that's, the first thing that popped into my mind. For Harold, and I guess for, was it, I don't usually like to put it this way, but you know what I mean. Was it worth it?
it was for me. Yeah, because I think you're the kind of person, you know, that I think I am. I'm always the investigator. I've got two things, Rowan. I think you know me well enough to know this. Is that I never had a problem with inferiority. it doesn't mean I'm overly boastful or anything like that. But the bottom line is I've never felt inferior to anybody. And my approach has always been, you got a problem, let's go. Let's figure it out. Met life, kind of head on. And that's the way I approached Tulane. It's contest, and we'll see who's standing, again at the end. And bottom line is, I think the reality is the lesson that we've all learned, going back all to into those days, is that we can compete. And the overriding message is that we don't want to say out loud, but maybe we should. Much of the time, we are superior. We are better. Than a lot of the competition and stuff. And I think a part of the problem historically, has been, folks wanted to prevent us getting to know that for as long as they could. So yes, I think it was absolutely worth it. And I think it continues to be because we're not finished yet. We got to continue pushing forward.
So
Steve, was it worth it?
So let me share with everyone that, I've been working in documenting my dad's story, and my dad was interviewed. Some of my comments will come exactly how he would respond to that question, which was asked. And like I started off, that my dad's story is complicated. He answers that question, was it worth it? It was not. He would not do this again. He was never in control of his journey. He was placed here at Tulane. He was placed in a sport that wasn't his best sport. He was not played because he didn't know the night before there was a death threat. So in his pain, and it's interesting to hear, and it's fortunate that 4 years later, the 3-year difference between my dad and Harold, right, and how he felt that at that point in time, this would have not been, in his words, worth it. And he would not have chosen to be a pioneer. He would not have wanted to. If you asked him, did he want to break the barrier again, he did not know he was being placed into this role. And so it makes that relationship very complicated. So I'll stop there.
Time-wise, because I don't want to leave anybody out, anything else you guys want to say? You two guys, before I get to these 1970s people?
Well, I'll just lead off and hand it off. So it goes chronologically for my father. Today, I think his response would be, I am happy to see where our black athletes here on Tulane are and where the campus is acknowledging and archiving its history. So that's a good thing. And I think that as my dad came back and forth into Tulane, both as a student, as a graduate student, as the internal auditor, I think the time period when Perry Clark and the basketball team started back up, they were specifically asked for Steve, my dad, to come back and be a part of welcoming those black athletes back on campus. That I would leave with that. That helped a lot in his healing. And because he was focused on education, so he chose not to go play professional baseball. So he was asked to go to the Angels. Education was the most important thing. And so his healing is that he got to see his children have a college experience he wished he had and end up with their terminal degrees. That was the healing part for him. Mm-hmm.
And at your father's death, he was doing what?
And landed where, as he told me, maybe my family would say something different, his dream job, which he became the CFO of Tuskegee University. And you would sit there and say, why dream job? He landed in a position of power on a black campus to help students to have that phenomenal college experience he was not going to have. But unfortunately, when he landed there, the tragedy of that story is 6 or 7 months he was then diagnosed with cancer and never really stepped into that role, and we never know the rest of that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I kind of don't have my watch here, but you know, you will be able to ask questions because I'm sure you have a lot of questions because I have questions, but it's not about me. I don't want to take up all the time. So let's move on to the 70s, where everything was good. They'd already, people, they paved the way for them and all that good stuff. Okay, they came here and it was just a layout. It was an absolute layout during the 70s. We got two of the best people around to talk about that time. John Washington, of course, as we said, he's with us by Zoom, but here in person is his classmate from 72, 73, 74. During those good times with the LSU football game that you hear about from 50 years ago, December 1st, 1993, beating LSU for the first time in 25 years. And it did all that because they had more black guys on their team than most of the other people then. That's, I'm just saying what people were saying then. I'm telling you what they were saying. And these were two of those black guys. Charlie Hall.
I agree.
Get up close to that mic and tell us your story. Coming here from Lake Charles.
First, I want to thank Steve. I want to thank Harold for what they did, because I didn't know the story until he was saying. First time I met Harold Sylvester, I think he was selling tall men clothes at the Bluff Commons when I first met him. Because I was impressed. But my story is a little bit different. I came up in an area where the school was 70% white, 30% black. So my adjustment coming to Tulane was not a color barrier. My barrier was education. I thought, and I heard him say Dave was academic. I thought I was academic till I stepped in at Tulane, and the professor started taking words out of a Newsweek magazine, spell these words. I'm like, man, I said, I don't know what words. I called my mom up. I said, I'm ready to come back home. She said, oh, no, you staying there. I'm like, Lord. But I was ready to leave. But on the backside of that, I had three guys. I remember their name, Harry Asher, Glenn Harden, and Ben Rollins. They was three white guys who helped me make the decision to stay. Because I tell you what, like I said, I was ready to get out of here. Because Tulane is academic. And I got my degree in physical education. The one thing that I enjoyed about Tulane, you had a tutoring system. The tutoring system was this, not like you guys do. We went to that particular person who was tutoring. We went to their room, and they was able to tutor us. But the biggest thing is we didn't have these big classrooms. So we were able to get more of an one-on-one type of work, whereas I'd have gone to LSU or something like that. I think it would have been a lot more difficult. But for me, myself, I was able to go through things and not have to deal with a lot. I didn't have a lot of racial type things to deal with at all. Even when I played football, we didn't have it. The only bad thing I ever heard, and I heard it from a black guy in Michigan. My sophomore year, they had a train station. They had a hospital. They had 110,000 people at the game. And this particular guy called me Uncle Tom. I said, Uncle Tom. Now, you know, I know what y'all know about Uncle Tom, but I read the book. And after reading the book, Uncle Tom told the guy, you're going to kill me before I give my soul to you. So it's just a little opposite. But hearing that from the black guy was sort of a, you know, something different. But as I stayed here and as I played here, you know, I was able to do a lot of things. And again, I thank Steve and Harold even though it was different sports, to pave the way. I didn't know nothing. The year I signed with Tulane, of course, my mom, she told me, you're going to Tulane. So like Harold said, back then, certain decision was made by certain people. My mom made the decision. And Jim Pittman was the coach then. He went to TCU later. But I heard the story that they told this one particular guy who was a black running back. One of the coaches say, I'm not prejudiced. I don't like blacks and Jews, but I'm not prejudiced. So they say the guy, the black guy, he went and played with Texas Southern. So when I came here, Dad left. And, you know, I didn't have that. I didn't have to deal with that. But my experience as an athlete, as a student at Tulane, was a great one. I didn't have many tragedies or faults at all. I was able to gel with everybody. The only people who got on us was the students, because they felt that at that time it was only three blacks, Robert Johnson, John Washington, who you hear from, and myself. They felt that we weren't really gelling with the students. And I knew the students that was there. They was there for one reason. They came to get education. They came to do whatever they was here for, whether it was going to be a doctor, a lawyer, whatever. Hey, I came in. I was a football player, you know. I played football. I didn't think I was going to be that. But, you know, as time went on, we got better. And I can say right now, Ro and everybody here, things have changed. We went to a meeting, and I was in the meeting. I'm like, I told John, I said, golly, I ain't never seen that many black guys before. And it was like the whole room, and you, well, for you, a few years before you, the whole room was a whole black guy, linebackers, black. And I'm like, wow, it was only three of us. We count on the fingers. So what has become at Tulane has become great. As far as the football part goes, and as far as the academics, you know, you get a school like Tulane, you don't have 30,000 or 40,000 students. You don't have to ride a bike for safety class. You can walk. If you get lost, that means that's your first day at school. and I say that's a big difference. But I'm just gratified and thankful for what I have. And I've learned a lot. I went through a lot. But my biggest thing is being able to take those things and put them in front of me, and I have become more and more of a person that does more with God. I'm a strong Christian.
All right, while you get yourself together, we're going to go to John Washington. John, tell us your story, your deal coming here.
Oh, thank you, guys. I've made a 10-minute drive from church back home. Ah. Charlie, you did a great job, man. Hey, anyway, again, like Charlie, following the protocol, would like to thank you, Ro. Like to thank the Tulane Black Association and Jim for setting this podcast up. You know, Charlie has hit the highlights of our migration to Tulane University. I'm coming from Texas. Charlie coming from Lake Charles, and Robert Johnson, which is no longer with us, was coming out of Dallas, Texas. Tulane was probably the best offer I had to choose from. I had SMU. I had Texas A&M and North Texas. And I chose Tulane because it was a little bit further away from home, 580 miles versus North Texas, which was 50 miles, versus SMU, which was 17 miles, and Texas A&M about 150 miles away. So, and A&M at the time were all boys, Harold. And I couldn't see myself being with all those guys. I've been with females my entire educational career. But as faith would have it, I went to Tulane in 71, Texas A&M with co-ed in 72. So I missed that by a year. But anyway, Charlie hit our highlights of coming to Tulane. When I went there, I didn't realize on my recruiting trip that there were no black showing me around, but it didn't register. I've been to, like I said, A&M. I've been to SMU. I had black and whites being host athletes. And when I got to Tulane, it didn't even dawn on me, especially when it took you down on Bourbon Street and you forgot everything that you went there to do. But going out on Bourbon Street was one of the deciding factors, and once being there. But once you got there, you realize quickly that you only go to Bourbon Street when people come in from out of town. It was a tourist attraction, and it never was a hangout for the locals. So, but like Charlie said, academia was the thing with Tulane. We slowly was infused with those African Americans that were there before us by a year or two. Ron Stevens, one come to mind, that made sure that we were inclusive with the regular student body. At that time, athletes were kind of separated from non-athletes, and we stayed in the athletic dormitory at Robert Sharp. And we just, you know, was kind of isolated. But one thing that Charlie didn't share, we were amongst the group that stopped the streaking. When streaking was becoming very, very popular, and you would get a little notification that University of Texas had 500 streakers. Tulane is going to be next. We're going to do this. Well, we didn't mind them streaking until we had a couple of athletes that got involved in the streaking. And one particular African-American athlete, and Charlie and I straightened him out real quick that, you know, you don't be representing us by streaking with those other people. So I don't know if Charlie remembered that, but we had one particular athlete that we kind of chastised. We were big brothers then. I think we were sophomores. And that next class that came behind us, we had to kind of do some orchestrating and straightening out some kids. But my Tulane experience was a wholesome one. I've made friends for a lifetime. I was sharing this with Jim, that my best friends are not from high school, but my best two friends is Charlie Hall and Wyatt Washington, both Tulane athletes and both Tulane graduates.
Mm-hmm. Wyatt Washington, yep. Murrow High School, Jackson, Mississippi.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'll ask you the same question, because this doesn't just stick for the people of the 60s and the pioneers like Harold and Steve. Mm-hmm. It was still a period in time where, you know, you had to worry about representation of the entire group, as you mentioned, about using the streaker thing. John, was it worth it? Because, you know, whether we, you know, I was being a little facetious talking about the good times of the 70s, but, you know, I'm the same age as you guys, maybe a little older. So, I mean, I know what you were going through during that time. Was it worth it, John Washington, you feel?
Roe, it was worth it. Looking back at it, being a trailblazer, being the first to do something has always never been a forethought, but an afterthought after you look it back over. Of all the choices I had to make and decisions to make, Tulane was the better decision that I made. It was worth it. My degree speaks for itself. You didn't ask me this, but I spent I'm retired now, but I spent 40 years in education. and my Tulane diploma opened many doors for me. So in hindsight, it was worth it. I don't mind being considered a trailblazer or the first to do something, but it was the sign of the times, and we just happened to be born during that time period.
Charlie Hall, was it worth it?
Oh, yes, it was worth it. Now that I look at everything that I done went through, and like John said, I was in education for 33 years. I was physical education teacher, and I just can say, when you say Tulane, people listen. And, you know, where I'm from, they got a lot of alumni set up for Tulane, and when they find out you're from Tulane, they're willing to do a lot of things for you. So it was worth the time that I spent here, the 4 years, and if I had to do it again, I would do it again. So thank you.
Charlie Hall and John Washington. Let's move on to a little bit later in the 70s. By 1978, this young lady became the first African-American female to get a, I guess they called them athletic grant and aid or whatever they called it then, here at Tulane University. She came from Grace King High School out in Metairie. She was a multiple year all-state player there. And well, I met her, to tell you the truth, I can't have met her because I was one of the weird people who was working in sports media at the time that did stories on girls playing basketball. And girls, you know, why are you doing that? Okay, but that's another story. Sharon Hill.
Hello, everyone.
Your Tulane story. How you doing, darling?
I'm doing great. Good to see you.
Give us your Tulane story. You heard all of these gentlemen talk about how they got here, when they got here, why they got here, the whole works. What about you?
Well, I've enjoyed hearing the stories that I've heard. They've been amazing, and congratulations to you gentlemen who made it, who gave people like myself strength to undertake such an enormous challenge. So, my mom raised 7 kids. My father was in the military. He died when I was 2. My mom worked as a housekeeper, and I had 4 sisters, 2 brothers. And out of the girls, I perhaps, without question, I was a tomboy. And to this day, I think of those boys who I caught football with and played basketball with on the canal bank, how they groomed and shaped me, actually, and prepared me for an opportunity at Tulane. I went to Grace King. I loved it, had a fantastic time there. Then was recruited by Tulane. And I had the opportunity to select where I wanted to go. I had several offers, about 26 approximately. But I chose Tulane because I wanted to invest in my future. And it has paid off. When I arrived at Tulane, I would pass the campus all the time, and I just would be in awe in terms of how beautiful it was. But not once did I think that I would actually set foot on that campus and be a student with my education paid for. So I've been really blessed, and I've not taken anything for granted. My players that I played with at Tulane, I think of them often. We were very different from very different cultures, and somehow or another, we were team-oriented. We had mutual respect, so I didn't go through the harshness of barriers that you gentlemen have gone through. Yes, I did have challenges. Education, definitely. Having to be on the road and hit your grades. If you didn't hit your grades, you didn't play. And I am grateful that I went to Tulane because I did not rely on athletics to get me where I wanted to go. So in short, if it was not for Tulane, I don't really know where I'd be. The caliber of jobs that I've had, I've worked in the Middle East region with the United Nations for 6 years. I've worked for Kellogg Brown and Root, and currently I'm area HR director in Charleston, South Carolina. The bottom line is that if I did not have Tulane University on that resume, I don't think, quite honestly, that I would, let's just say, would have been as noticeable, as sought after. The name goes a long way, and I'm very grateful that during the good times and the bad times, the hard times, if I had to do it all over again, absolutely. And I think that's why we're athletes, because we like to win. And I like playing it forward, reaching back and helping others like myself, who grew up in a middle-class family that was just trying to do better than their mom did or their father did. And I hope to this day that my mom's proud of me. Thank you.
Sharon, a quick question I wanted to ask you. Did you feel like a pioneer?
I really didn't know what I was walking into. As one of the gentlemen said, I didn't really know what I was walking into. I guess maybe now I do. But at that time, I knew that I was the only black person there, and I thought that was weird, you know. And I saw so many Caucasian people on campus. That was weird, too, and there was a handful of black folks there, and I'm like, okay, then this is it. This is what I signed up for. And that was a challenge in terms of culture differences in migrating with these people. And the majority of my interactions were good. I still keep in touch with a lot of them. So for me, it wasn't about black or white. It was about who's, it was about academic. It was about experiencing different cultures, and just wanting to win, being a part of a winning team and making a difference.
This is an athletic, okay, basic thing, because there are athletes, but it seems like it's significant, I think, and, you know, everybody's talked about academics in that story. Everybody's talked about academics. And I think, do we tend to sometimes overlook that part of it, that not only was it what they were doing on the athletic field or the court, but they had to compete and, you know, excel or not excel in the classroom? Charlie, you mentioned that first. I mean, how do you guys feel about that?
Well, basically, if you don't get the grade, you don't get to play.
Absolutely.
And like I said, I was just overwhelmed when, like I say, when I went in the classroom and this guy started doing Newsweek, and I just blew my mind, because I thought I had a good educational background, but I didn't. And like I said, just the idea of the people reaching out to show they care for me, they want to see me make it, that made a difference. But you know, academics at Tulane stand for academics. Mm-hmm. It does.
Go further back. Harold, the academic side of it. The academic side of it here in your student life.
Yeah, it's extremely important. For me, it was team and team. Most people, curriculum like English or biology or that kind of stuff. My curriculum was theater and psychology. And so both disciplines that are team forming in themselves. And so I was whatever classroom I was in, I was a team member. You know, when we're doing plays, you know, it's the same as strapping on that uniform for basketball. That kind of characterized my experience, finding where I belonged, in all the classworks, in all the disciplines of classwork. And so I had my problems, there's no question about it. You know, I couldn't pass a statistics course today in psychology. You know, neither can I pronounce it, apparently. But it all worked. And I think the other thing, that was happening for me, again, academically, I think I might have shared the story with some of you at some point. I had a problem with the sense of history of the people who were on that campus. I'm a member of the theater department, you know, and I'm watching theater, you know, happen in New York, you know, doing all the reading about the new playwrights, Ed Bullins and Mary Baraki, who was in Leroy Jones at the time. There was a street revolution going on. Richard Wesley, you know, who I'm working on a project with now, they were all doing it, you know, in New York. I was trying to write about it, you know, at Tulane, and twice. It only happened twice. Turned in term papers, documented what was going on, got an F each time, you know, for lack of annotation. And I argued to the professor, who happened to be the head of the department, that history is being made. There's no annotation. This paper, hopefully, one day with the F scratched off, it's going to be the annotation. It was about getting an education and teaching them at the same time about what your culture was about. And I think if there were bumps in the road, it was always about that. You know, there were actually times on the academic side when I felt like you're not dealing with what I need to know. You know, and so, because you don't want to know what I already know. So yeah, that was a bit of a dilemma. But, you know, once again, you know, the battle, you know, I mean, for me, was worth it. And so, because I think, you know, I got through to somebody sometimes, and it seems to have been enough.
Okay, did we lose Sharon? I don't know.
I'm still here.
Okay, you're still there.
I'm still here.
Right. Okay. All right. Before I move to Cincy, I wanted to ask you, the previous guys, be it Steve, be it Harold, even to a degree, be it John and Charlie, there was a degree of people kind of placing them here or nudging them here for a reason or reasons. Did you have or feel any of that, that you were told, well, you need to go here instead of there because dot, 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 whatever?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah, for you, Sharon, yeah. Did you have any of that?
Oh, absolutely. My high school coach, Ron Smith, who I absolutely adored and had a lot of respect for, he wanted me to go elsewhere. And Charlie Domino was a coach of AAU, and he nudged me with Tulane. He really did. My next-door neighbor, Robert Dawson, he was a med student at Tulane, and he spoke very highly of it and edged me to go to Tulane. But at the end of the day, I needed to find what worked for me, and it was Tulane. It was Tulane, but that was my choice.
Okay, Sharon Hill, don't go away. We're coming right back to you.
But, okay.
okay. Let's go to where, you know, everything is hunky-dory now. Yeah. I mean, come on. You know, I mean, double-digit wins, two straight years, Cotton Bowl, beating USC, NFL scouts, All-American honors, buildings here that these guys had no thought about when they were here. Facilities, you know, football back on campus, 50,000 less seats, but back on campus. Sincere Haynesworth. Any of this stuff sound familiar even in the year 2024?
You know what? There's a lot that there is parallels, but it's for sure completely different from what's been described. Like you said, it's pretty smooth, but as everyone knows here, we have our own challenges dealing with, you know, race and everything going on in the world right now. Part of the reason I minored in political science, that's something that, you know, I wanted to learn about as much as I could. And, you know, I had that opportunity because, you know, everyone here speaking and, you know, everyone here today. So I'd like to start first by saying, you know, thank you to everybody. And I appreciate you guys having me on to, you know, see these parallels and allow me to, you know, talk and give my side as well. But, you know, just for starters, you know, just academics is you know, that's always been the driving factor, whether it's, you know, learning, you know, as Mr. Charlie said, learning how to, you know, approach academics, especially coming from, you know, maybe places where that's not as prevalent, you're not really, you know, pushed as much to pursue academics as much as athletics. Definitely something that's very important. It's actually a part of the recruiting pitch at Tulane here now. You know, it not being a 4-year decision, but a 40-year decision. You know, setting yourself up for success with the, you know, the weight of this degree, the weight of, you know, everything you go through at Tulane. You hear a lot around the country of, you know, other schools, big programs, giving tons of extra help to athletes to help them outside of, you know, what they actually need, kind of babysitting them and holding their hand through it. That's not happening here at Tulane at all. Definitely an academic school. You will go to your classes. You will be checked to make sure you go to your classes, and you will pass those classes, or you're not gonna play. You're not gonna, you know, earn that starting position. It's just something that's a part of the culture here is academics.
What sounds familiar to you then? Is there anything or that you have heard these previous gentlemen and lady say that, yeah, I still have that?
Yeah. There's a little bit of, you know, as much as I can think is there's still not enough lead representation from black people here at Tulane. You know, there's, you know, growing presence of staff and faculty member, but it's still a predominantly white institution. Mm-hmm. You know, while we may not, you know, experience those same things, you know, breaking color barriers, things of that nature, we still don't have, you know, as much guidance as someone growing up in this society. You know, growing up as, you know, I'm 22 years old. I haven't had to deal with a ton of, you know, racial bias, but, you know, I am starting to see these things in the media more prevalent, things becoming more about race in the media is more and more things that I haven't had to deal with. And it's, you know, it has been tough navigating those things, you know, as a college student today with not a lot of guidance from staff or coaches and things of that nature. You know, it's not an HBCU where, you know, everyone around you is black and has experienced those things. Some people you have to find a common ground, and while that's a beautiful thing of finding how to navigate that and how to relate with people in that nature, there's something about not really having that presence, you know, just so easily and so accessible.
Mm-hmm. Old people on the panel. What do you think about that presence that Sincere is talking about, that lead presence? Could you ever have imagined then something like that even happening at Tulane, having any degree of, as he called it, lead presence? Anybody?
You know, I think it may not be apparent as it should be. But I think there is some happening there, you know, even as we speak. You know, you got to look at people like, you know, Carol and Barbara Pierre. You know, who is there? Carol Bebel, you know, who is doing some community liaison stuff between Tulane and the rest of New Orleans. Some of the contemporary students and stuff who are reflecting on, you know, what we did in the past. And I'll give you one example, Football 70. You know, that was entirely a student initiative.
Harold, stop. They don't know what you're talking about when you say Soul Bowl 70. We do. Tell them.
Have they not got the internet, bro?
They don't know. Tell them. It's the news coming out in me. You can't assume they know.
Guys, well, you know, we actually put together a concert in 1970. We started, obviously, the year before. Student-driven and proposed, you know, that we take Tulane Stadium and just invite, you know, the best contemporary artists and have a concert in order to raise funds for scholarships for Africa.
Okay, and tell them who was in this concert.
It was.
Who was on the bill?
The bill was Ike and Tina Turner, James Brown, Isaac Hayes, Help me out.
That's enough right there, okay? All right, you can go on what you're saying. I just wanted to make sure they knew what Soul Bowl 70 was.
Rare Earth, Junior Walker, and the All-Stars. it went on and on and on. But, you know, bottom line is, you know, successful on a lot of levels. The first thing that had to happen was we had to convince the community that surrounds Tulane that it was all right, you know, for 50,000 black folks to come to the neighborhood. first hurdle that we were able to get over. You know, but the bottom line is we did it, and it happened. And as I said in that little video, we made a ton of money. That's not true. We did not make money. And so, but you know, we I think changed lives because the conception of us, you know, who we were, changed at that instant. And so, because it was a powerful demonstration of something, and it was a big achievement, again for the time. But I think that presence now continues, and as I mentioned, Carolyn Barber Pierre, and you know, the number of people that are on the board of directors, the Tulane trustees. The increasing number of professors. You've got to, I think, take a hard look at that. And so, because in my day, there was zero of any of those kinds of people. And so, but I think now, the alumni, alumni and student body, are the strengths of any university. And we've got enough in critical places, to actually change the world. Roy, I think I've said this, to you before. Positive things are happening, with Jim Fitz, as a result, you've got this All-Star game that's happening on campus today. You've got all these black folks, on campus for this reunion. Starting to feel a little bit like an HBCU to me. if you're just thinking in those terms, we have come a long, long way. And let's keep moving.
Any other panelists?
I can say today, Tulane, maybe let's put it back in 1971 and 72, whatever. Tulane was a diverse type of school back then. I saw the discussions they were having. I can't think of the particular candidate was running for president that come through Tulane. But when I looked at Tulane and I looked at the students, where they came from, we had a bunch of kids from the East Coast. We had a lot of Jewish kids. I just thought Tulane, once I can understand, was a very diverse school compared to a lot of the state schools. I'm just speaking about Louisiana itself. So when I look at Tulane, they say Tulane is the Harvard of the South. And I might not have been the greatest kid of education, but I could understand. And I look at it today, and as me and John saw in the meeting, just not the other day, just see how the students today interact with each other at Tulane compared to when I was here. So I think Tulane, as Harold said, has made a lot of strides. We have a lot of black scholars who's doing a lot. So overall, Tulane has gotten a good grade. So that was just on my mind. I just had to let it out.
John, Sharon, anything you want to say? This isn't the end of this. We're going to take a short break, and then we have questions for you guys because, you got to have some questions. And go on.
I would like to add to something that Charlotte said earlier is that, even though he said we were just PE students, but you got to understand that back when we were going through, they were developing the university college. And even though we were PE majors, we had most of our undergraduate class were future doctors. We had kinesiology, physiology. We had the PE courses of the actual sports that we were in training with. But most of our coursework was with pre-med students. So don't think that when he said PE, oh, those are a bunch of dumb jocks. We were trained and taught to be along with future doctors of this country. So, but academia has always been a strong point. And, you know, I started in education as a teacher and a coach, went into administration, and rose to be an assistant superintendent, and 40 years of doing it. So it's with that solid background and education I got undergraduate from Tulane University. So academia and academics is very, very high. And Charlie quit saying that it's just an old PE teacher. I mean,
what a curve.
All right.
And you know, John and Charles, you mentioned that the PE thing. You know, I can remember that I got this from my father, who knew everything, as far as I was concerned, especially at that particular time. When Tulane did emphasize athletics in the 50s. Athletics, they did. You know, that's when they got out of the SEC and all that. And then they made it so that you couldn't major in physical education, he told me. They brought it back. Okay? They brought it back by that time. But they had gotten rid of the possibility of majoring in physical education. And like you said, when it came back, I've talked to people like you before, you know, it was nothing but science.
Yeah, it's tough.
it was nothing but really science classes, to tell you the truth. And so I know exactly what you mean. Sharon, anything you got to say before we go to break on this or anything?
No, I completely agree with what I've just heard. I believe that was the excitement of being a student at Tulane, the diversity. People from all walks of life, even though we had very few black representation there, the cultural experience was outstanding. And I think that everyone that I was with on my team and students that I met, medical students, dental, archaeologists, engineers, the whole ball of wax. So the opportunity was there. You just had to go and get it and go and take it. And that's what I did.
Oh, academics, education, representation. Those are three words that, you know, I keep hearing a lot in this thing. Different times, too, things being done for different reasons, and people coming here for different reasons, and some people coming here on their own volition, some people being, like you said, like Steve said, steered here and expected to carry a mantle and carry a heavy, heavy load. Take a break right now, a short break. Questions, when we come back, don't leave. It won't be long. Sharon, John, Harold, Stephen, Sincere, Charlie, thank y'all. That doesn't mean we're getting rid of you. You're not finished yet. We still got work to do. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with all your questions.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
All right, you guys, we're going to get started with questions.
Chicago.
Yeah. Questions and answers.
Oh, man, snow.
To get started, first I want to ask the panel, do you have any questions for anybody else that's on the panel? So can you guys, y'all can ask your questions to each other right now. Let's start with that. Y'all been listening? You don't have any questions?
I heard you, ma'am.
I've got a statement.
Okay.
I would love to thank Charlie Hall for not bringing up the recruiting trip that he took.
Okay.
John Washington alluded to his. I had the pleasure of taking Charlie on his when he was a recruit. And so I'm thanking him now for not bringing it up.
Oh, Chris Owens, oh, okay. All right.
Chris Owens, okay.
And then all one question we have from everybody was, how did you get out the closet with the two women? We need to know. We need to have that information.
Harold, that's not my question, okay? That was not my...
We need to know.
Are we recording?
Yes, we are.
If you go back and review the video, it did not say two... It said two naked white people. It was not two women. It was a man and a woman, you know, and I politely walked out, you know, because I was not supposed to be there. You know, I have to tell you the whole story for it to make sense, you know, but I was very out of place for a number of reasons. Being the only one with clothes was the start, you know. So it was a different time.
All right, you guys, and another question to, go ahead.
Yeah, Harold, I want to ask you a question. I know you played against Pete Maravich. Just want to know, how did that game go? How did you feel while playing against a person like Pete and Apple? I remember Apple Sanders, I think, so I know you was the only brother out there, but how did you play that game?
You know, that's a whole long story. I'll give you a capsule. Yeah, I knew Pete from high school and stuff because they were trying to recruit me, you know, to LSU. You know, as you remember, his dad was the coach and all that stuff, and we could have played together and stuff. So we were actually friends, before, we're in combat, you know, against each other. But, you know, the first time we played him, you know, again, was in December 68 in a triple overtime game.
Wow.
We beat them 101-99. But the bottom line is we beat them. In the course of that game, there was a riot. You know, a riot broke out, and the state police had to come in to clear the court. And we finished the game with them standing around the edges of the court. You know, and then consequently, after the game, after we won, they escorted us all the way back into New Orleans. And so that was the beginning of my personal rivalry with LSU and Pete Maravich, and that was of course the year that we beat them, you know, in 68-69 we beat them twice.
Wow.
And stuff. So it was an eventful, you know, first varsity year, you know, for me, you know, and for Pete as well. And a little side story. 20 years later, and this is the honest God truth, 20 years after that game in 1969. You know, I get a, it happened on my birthday, February 10th. I'm reading the LA Times, and there's a sports article, you know, that says, 20 years ago today, you know, Tulane, in the picture of me and Pete, it says, LSU's Pete Maravich drives around Tulane's Harold Sylvester to score two of his 66 points. You know, and then they gave the score. I went ballistic. Because he did score 66 on me, the defensive specialist. But we won the game, and that was the whole thing. So Harold, I hope that characterizes, that whole year. It was eventful.
Harold, this is Roe. You go to the Maravich Assembly Center and you walk around the concourse. There's a picture of Pete Maravich. Guess who's guarding him? I was there 2 weeks ago.
Amazing. Yep.
Guess who's guarding him?
not
me,
but you.
Well,
you know what? You know, but see, that wasn't the worst of it, man. He only got 66 the second night. You know, but the night before he got 70. So I improved by 4 points.
All right. Anybody out there in the hallway want to come in? We got questions. Anybody has a question? Come on up. We've got Sharon Hill, the first African-American female to get an athletic scholarship at Tulane. We've got John Washington, 72, 73, 74, defensive back. Harold Sylvester, the first African-American male to get an athletic scholarship at Tulane. Steve Martin Jr., the son of the late Steve Martin Sr., who was the very first African-American athlete at Tulane and in the Southeastern Conference. Charles Hall, All-American defensive tackle in 1972, 73, 74 here at Tulane, and current All-American Sincere Haynesworth. Yes, sir. Your name and question.
My name is Brian Stewart, and I have a question to this directed to all of you. What is your favorite or most impactful memory at Tulane?
Favorite most impactful memory at Tulane. Who wants to go first? Charlie?
I would say my most, took to my sophomore year, now to think about it, they had a running back from Boston College named Esposito. And I don't know, it looked like I ran six, seven miles to tackle him. I don't know if it went right, but that probably was that. And then the second one was beating LSU in 1973. I was sitting on the bench, and this is a strange thing. You know, everybody's screaming and howling, and all they say, we fumble. So I had to sprint on the field. So those are the two most memorable ones that I can think of right now.
And he won't mention it, but he probably played with a knee injury that day that he probably shouldn't have played with.
Okay.
And he played, okay? And he really did play. He won't mention that part. So I'll mention that part for him. Before we come back to the table, how about Sharon? Are you still there?
Yes, I am. Yes, sir.
What was the question?
What is your favorite, most impactful moment during your time at Tulane?
When I received my degree and had it in my hands.
Okay, that sounds good. How about John Washington?
Like Charlie, I would mention two games. First one is when we played Pittsburgh and Tony Dorsett. And the other one was the LSU Tulane game in 73. Those were, you know, two big games. And he did mention one at the University of Michigan with Shuttlesworth, and we had over 100,000 people in attendance. That was pretty memorable. But for big old Michigan to run the score up on us, but we held our own for a little team out of the South. But, and like Miss Hill said, getting that degree was probably the ultimate gift from Tulane University.
And by the way, Tulane beat Pitt with Tony Dorsett that year, his freshman year. Of course, 3 years later, they were national champions, but Tulane beat them then. Harold?
Ask Charlie who took him out.
Oh, my God.
The Washington brothers. Why didn't John?
Harold, most memorable or impactful?
Impactful and kind of life-changing. Freshman year, and I'm going to mention his name because the outcome is ultimately positive. But you know, my recruiting coach was a guy named Tom Nosalke. And I don't know if that rings a bell to anybody, because he went on, never became head coach at Tulane, interim for a time, but he went on to the NBA. And was actually coach of the year, both in the old ABA and the NBA. Pretty good coach. This incident happened, my freshman year, playing against Perkinson Junior College in Mississippi. And Tulane was concerned because there I was, the only African-American on their team, and we were going into Mississippi for the first time. So they actually brought along a couple of guys who were carrying guns. They were pretend coaches. Who are really bodyguards. And we get to Perkinson, and the first surprise is that Perkinson's entire team was black. Shocker. The real impactful moment came when I was not apparently not having a particularly good game. And Thomas Sauter pulled me out of the locker room into the hallway and literally pushed me up against the wall, and in my face says, "You're playing like a nigger."
Ooh.
Whoa. That's how it felt to me. So long story short, we go back in the game, and I couldn't see. I was blind. I lasted maybe another minute. I was hitting everything that moved. And I fouled out. But the bottom line is, and the reason why that was most impactful is because I did not deal with it. I could have had a number of different reactions, at the moment. And so, but we reconciled, you know, essentially. We had a number of incidents, again, over that year. And so, but we reconciled over the process of 40 years, because Tom Mesalky knew that we had a problem, and I never let him forget that we had a problem. But every time, he was in a town that was close to where I was, he'd call up and invite me to come in and sit on a bench, with his teams. Over the course of those 40 years, we came to terms with that moment, and stuff. And when he died, in the mid-teens, we were actually friends for the first time. And that has meant, through my life, that has meant a whole hell of a lot. Having a problem, confronting the problem, and resolving the problem. That characterized my whole Tulane experience.
Steve. So I will say for my father, there are four impactful ones along his journey. One of the most impactful situations was the loss of Coach Ben Abadie when, as my dad indicated, he was pushed out in 19 after his sophomore year. Coach Abadie, just real quickly, didn't see color when it came to his players. He put the best players on the field, but B, he didn't put my father on the field because he got the death threats and never told my father. Interesting. So impactful. My dad was truly lost when Coach Abadie left Tulane. The second is the friendships along the way, from Harold to Wayne Lee to Reynold Daku, who was the first African-American to graduate in 4 years from Tulane. The third, and putting Reynold in connection, Reynold also went to St. Augustine and was a year ahead of my father. The third impactful was that Reynold introduced my dad to my mother in 1967. So he met my mother here at Tulane, but she didn't go to Tulane at that time.
That's kind of impactful.
Impactful. And then finally, the fourth impactful, as we all heard the threading theme, is he got his degree, which was critically important for his parents.
Do you have an impact? You're part of this panel.
Absolutely. So I would say the most impactful moment during my time here at Tulane was, I believe it was my sophomore year, really at the start, I'll say, well, not the start, but start/height of kind of just everything, the social injustice movements that have been going on for the past few years. We started an initiative and within the football team called Wave of Change, and it was kind of a time for us to, put football aside and, talk about our differences as, such a diverse team. We have, from white, black, Asian, Hispanic, all types of different, backgrounds and people able to, put ball aside, because that's usually what brings us together, and talk about those differences and, really help educate each other to, go out and then educate more people. That's why we called it the Wave of Change, because, that conversation had to be started somewhere. So to, be able to sit in that environment and have that conversation, it really helped me a lot in understanding, everything going on, and understanding the differences of people, and, being able to carry that on and, take that elsewhere in life. It was definitely the most impactful moment for me during my time at Tulane.
Thanks for your question, sir. Navigating the muddy waters from Steve Martin to the Cotton Bowl. Next question. Name, please.
I'm Journey Smith. I'm a senior here at Tulane. And my first part of my question is for Mr. John, and it's asking about the SEC. So after the Cotton Bowl, and with Tulane ranking so high, especially this season, at the beginning of the season, there's been a lot of conversation about Tulane and its like relationship with the SEC. So my first part of my question is,
why do you think, like, what were the motivating factors for Tulane to leave the SEC? And then Sincere, what was the second part of my question? Oh, how do you think Tulane would have been different if we were still in the SEC, like facility-wise, like funding-wise? What changes do you think would be made if we were still in the SEC?
Yeah, and that's a question for who?
The first part is for John about...
For John Washington?
Actually, I'll jump in and let John. From what I understand, interesting enough, with the SEC, the decision on campus, and Ann can correct me if I'm wrong on that, which was the decision to leave the SEC was due to a faculty revolt, as I understand it, that the institution did not want to spend money on athletics, ironically. And so instead of funding up athletics, Tulane went down the academic route. Now, you would sit here and say they should have followed Vanderbilt and could have a big check now and just take the bumps, but that was the decision, in 1964, it was voted on, and then 1965 is when, at the end of that time period, that's the end of my father's sophomore year, that the institution decided to move away from the SEC.
You didn't ask me, but there has always been, whether they want to admit it or not, a fairly substantial faction of people on campus who don't want any athletics here at all. That's not new. That goes back. That goes back. I mean, that's not something that just started. I mean, that goes back when Tulane was a power like Alabama is in football, and Tulane was that way in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Okay. And goes even that far back. And so there's always been that. And like I always said, but that's a good question. I mean, the rest of you guys can ask how different it would be. And Steve kind of touched on it. Vanderbilt gets the same size check that Alabama and LSU gets every year. Okay? They get the same size check. And
we know
what that is. Georgia Tech left the year before. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Pointing to Notre Dame, mm-hmm. an academic institution,
yep.
that they can be successful.
That's true. That's correct.
And to answer the second part of your question, I think if we were to have been in the SEC leading up to the point we're at now, I think we would have, had the means and the facilities to get to this point a lot quicker. Like they've mentioned, the checks that these schools get, they allow for just more space for, each team to have their own workout facilities, cafeterias, things of that nature. We're just recently learning how to, compete with these other schools without having the same access to facilities and things of that nature. So, by now, I think it hasn't made as much of a difference because we're starting to learn how to work around those things, it takes a certain type of recruit to be able to thrive in that environment, and to have less money and less facilities, things of that nature, to still be able to perform at that level. We're just now kind of finding what it takes to be able to do that. I think it's not as necessary anymore. I think we're starting to, build in our own way, as we've seen with the success in the past few years, and a precursor to that success in the earlier years as well. But just really now, understanding what it takes, especially with the help of NIL, I think it means a lot less.
And Roel, circling back a little bit just to add, I recall that Coach Abadie made a decision and commented in the Times-Picayune at one point that I would never bring my teams back to an LSU town. And you would think actually it was racial, but ironically it was umpiring that it couldn't be fair. Now, there are hidden threads of racism in why he didn't want to bring his teams back to Starkville, to Oxford, or to particularly Tuscaloosa. So that likely helped the campaign to move out of the SEC. So there's all these threads and facets going on, But to Rose, your real major point that there was always this tension on campus about athletics and academia.
In 1925, Alabama, I think, may have been the first SEC school to play in the Rose Bowl. And the reason why Alabama got a chance to play in the Rose Bowl is because Tulane turned the Rose Bowl down. They were missed too much class. Yes, sir. Question?
Good afternoon, name everyone. Wayne Dawson, class of 92. And I wanted to just ask, well, a couple things. Ms. Hill, my uncle, also encouraged me to go to Tulane. He was the first one in our family to go to Tulane, although I was originally slated to go to Rice University. And so I wanted to ask you guys, did y'all have any memories of playing in the Southern Ivy League during that time? And I know we played Rice last year. Was that the first time that we played Rice back since the time that they realigned the conferences and the teams?
Yes, sir. That was the first matchup since before conference, the switch from Conference USA, I believe.
Right. So if anybody could speak to the whole Southern Ivies, that was, I think that was supposedly, was it a league? Was it an established league? Or was that just something?
Well, when you say Southern, who was in this league?
Well, I was told that it was like Rice and all these other, you know,
no, there was
upper
never,
crust Ivy League S type
there
schools.
There was never a, because at the time you're talking about, Rice used to be in the Southwest Conference, mm-hmm. with Texas and Texas A&M. You know, that's where they were. That's where they were before, you know, Conference USA or whatever they're in now. They were one of they were Southwest Conference team. So no, there was no
official Southern Ivies that was kind of spoken of. That's kind of what I was talking
about. Yeah, no, I'm not aware of that. I might be wrong, but I'm not aware of anything like that.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Ms. Hill, if you could comment about, you know, your time playing, if you don't mind. I can't see you.
Ms. Hill, she's there. I think she's there. Sharon?
Not cooking.
Are you there? Sharon?
Well, anyway, I'm glad we beat Rice because I live in Houston, and so there's always that competition. So
there you go. There you go. Yes, sir. Name and question.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Talk louder.
Jesus.
Okay. My name is Justin Thompson. I kind of have an array of questions, but I'm going to try and get some quick answers. So with the winning of the Cotton Bowl, I noticed that things on campus started to speed up. The things started to speed up in terms of development, in terms of river, the hall I live in, lake, and everything else. And also, you kind of started to see an improvement in options. And so, campus options in terms of food, in terms of just different programs being offered. And it made me think of LSU in a way that LSU has all these different retailers, these mainstream retailers that at one point we didn't have. So when we got Payway, I was like, oh, we must be moving into a more state set of mind, state university set, state of mind, being that we won the Cotton Bowl and the impact of football. So that made me also lead to the conclusion that we may be going to a bigger conference and possibly losing the status of what was once considered a top-tier Tulane. And I guess it's for you, Sincere, since this happens during your tenure here. So do you think that impact and the impact of football will lead us to provide more options and provide more development, yet lower different standards in terms of, you know, making it easier for athletes to get here, so on and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely.
And will that lead to a bigger conference for us?
Yeah, absolutely. To your point, winning the Cotton Bowl, it definitely brings in more revenue for the school in general. Gives us more screen time, allows us to have more publicized games, put us on ESPN, more primetime games, all that stuff. It pays the university money along with higher matchups. For example, we played Ole Miss this year. That's a out of conference matchup. We're technically playing up in conference, so school receives money in that sense as well. So just putting us in these better opportunities in these bigger stadiums, bigger venues, it definitely brings us more money, more revenue to share amongst the entire school. As far as moving in conference, you know, that's a something that's more out of our hands. It's definitely something that can be in talks, and you know, there's a bunch of conference realignment stuff going on. There's a lot that goes into that as far as stadium capacity, for one. It's something we would have to, you know, add the option to have more fans available in our stadium to, you know, be able to move up. Yes, to, you know, continue to move, you know, up in stadium. That means more fans are coming, we're getting more recognition. So there's a lot to go into it, but definitely trending in that direction. We're, you know, we're really at the point of, you know, the teams that just left our conference, U of H, Cincinnati, I think SMU just left as well, UCF, all of those schools went through a time period where they started to see a turnaround in the recruits they're getting, the development of the schools and the teams, just really taking a step forward. And that started, you know, a few years ago. We're just now starting to hit the, you know, like the start of that trajectory going up. And so it will take a few years, I think, but as long as we keep having the success we've had the past couple years, it will definitely, you know, be something that's in talks and available.
Gotcha. My second question would be for Sharon. I wanted to see if she could talk to the differences in resources provided at that time for women's basketball compared to maybe football and other men's sports, if she's on right now.
She had to sign off. Sorry.
Okay. Well, my last question was for all the older gentlemen, if that's a nice way to put it.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm retired.
Look at John.
I'm ready, John, brother.
If that's a better way to all our seasoned saints.
How would you guys like to see Tulane kind of solidify your impact and your legacy on this campus? For example, I talked to Stephen about how when I was Googling who was the first athlete, I'm from Baton Rouge, so all you hear about is College Temple, College Temple, College Temple. Mm-hmm. But when I was looking for my own school, Harold would come up more than Stephen Martin. I think I found only one article related to your dad. But what does it look like for the university to solidify that legacy? Is that a statue? Is that a building? Is that a scholarship? What would that look like?
Just speaking from what we have done, one guy who I played with, Harold Asher, he has done a lot. You know, we got recognized, I might tell him if I'm right, John, last year for the Cincinnati game, a year before, they recognized the first black in football. Right. And I think he tried to do something, but the recognition that they have shown as far as Mean John has been great. You know, because before it was nothing, but now they're starting to recognize. And I think it's all over the United States. They've got a lot of campuses now that's looking at the blacks, recognizing them, showing the recognition that probably we should have got, like he said, his dad, what his dad did. I can remember Jerry Levis, the first black who played at SMU. But I'm saying now more and more today, the recognition of what brown color has done in sports is starting to be recognized. But I know one guy, Harry Asher, has done a lot at Tulane University to recognize what we have done as far as John and myself go.
Gotcha. Justin, repeat your question for the people on Zoom, for John, Harold.
So my question was, how would you like to see Tulane solidify your legacy on campus, whether it looks like a scholarship, whether it looks like a building?
Don't tell them what. Just how would you like to see it?
Yeah. How would you see it? How would you like to see it?
Harold?
Harold, you're green.
We're not too old to get some of that NIL money.
Reparations.
Exactly. And, you know, and the plan that I'm thinking about and I'm actually working on, it's just to do what Charlie just started, is that little capsule profiles on who the players were, you know, through the history, you know, beginning in the university. And I think that doesn't just include African-Americans. You know, there's a special section, you know, I think, for African-Americans. But bottom line is, we know each other's records and stats and that kind of stuff. We don't really know each other as human beings, as people. It'd be nice to just capsulize, some of those stories and put it on something that invent something. Call them like baseball cards, basketball cards, whatever you want to do. But little biographies, if I can, that we can distribute, to people who might want to know, what the past has been.
John?
Well, I don't think, I'm just speaking personally, that I will probably never get a building named after me. But just to record us in history in the proper chronological order, and you can see how Tulane has changed and built on the fact that Harold Sylvester was the first African-American basketball player, that John Washington, Robert Johnson, and Charlie Hall were the first three African-Americans in 1971. Just include us in history and portray us accurately as our roles as being pioneers or trailblazers into that great university.
If I could interject on that a little bit as well. I think one thing that has solidified at least these two gentlemen and your father in history, the Stephen Martin Scholarship Award or Scholars Award presented yearly to a student athlete, one male, one female black student athlete, to just highlight the achievements they've done in their respective sport and in academics. I was actually lucky enough to receive that a couple years ago. I think that's a great way to honor late Stephen Martin. And then Mr. Charlie right here, I walk past his picture every day for 5 years up in the facilities, and got to hear a lot about Mr. John Washington as well. The pioneers of Tulane football, who broke the color barrier for Tulane football. So it's pretty awesome to have at least those little tidbits to that's how I learned who Stephen Martin was. I was able to go do my research and learn in that way, and to have like you said, I believe it was Cincinnati last year, to have these gentlemen come and speak to us and be honored as well. I think that's a great start, but to your question, it's just a start. I think there's definitely more that can be done. Something that could be displayed for everyone to see, not just in that section of Wilson where football players may see and do their research, but it's important for all student athletes to know this information.
Stephen, anything you want to say on that?
I would just like to compliment Tulane since 2015 when the SEC was recognized, going through its 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And my family wrote the SEC and just reminded him a little bit about history. I'm glad to see the Tulane, the admission leading the Tulane History Project. I think the accuracy and the documentation, and as well as all of these gentlemen have said, that just ensuring that it's there and available and documenting is a wonderful step, and it would have helped quite a bit in my dad's healing as he went forward. So great work by Tulane so far. Got to keep pushing, though.
Yeah, and that's a good point that Stephen makes right there, especially for you, Justin, because, College Temple wasn't the first at LSU. But that's what everybody says.
You just told me something. You just underread 20 years.
Ask Collis Temple who hosted him on his recruiting trip to LSU. He'll tell you it was Lloyd Wills from Carver High School here in New Orleans. Wow. But he was a track guy, so they don't count him, I guess. But he was there before Collis and competing and making all SEC, too.
The more you know.
It kind of goes to what Steve just said about, that you had to call the SEC and let them know.
And ironically, fortunately, it was quite easy because actually the commissioner at that time was the commissioner before he got to the SEC was the American Conference.
So, live.
Yeah, so he knew Tulane. And he quickly told the staff, as he told shared, is that, oh, yeah, Tulane was still in the SEC. And, oh, yeah. And so it was really good that we have this opportunity to really begin to document all of this work.
Good question.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Come on up. State your name.
My name is Jim Becknell. And first, I want to thank all you guys for being here today. To have, you know, people with created history being trailblazers and being able to pass some of this on to everybody and make it available is a wonderful thing. So thank you again for being here. And Harold, I can tell you at least one university, the athletic department, has started NIL for previous players.
Uh-oh.
Where they sell their jerseys and they give a percentage back to the player. So maybe we need to push them to do that here. Huh?
So
my question for you guys.
Yeah, he likes that. He's Look
thinking
at
about it. My question is going to be a little bit different for all of you. What was your worst moment at Tulane? Because oftentimes, kind of what defines us is going through and struggling through difficulties and using our support networks and what have you to get through it. So what was your worst moment at Tulane?
I can start on that. Definitely during my junior season, we went 2-10 and we're just going through a lot of rough moments and rough times, just in general with you know, staff members, with players on the team, just all of us in general, not having a great time. Of course, that was the year we got relocated to Birmingham. During Ida. Just a really tough experience to kind of, and very humbling as well, to, you know, not have, you know, the immediate support of, you know, everyone around you, because we weren't on campus for the first part of that season. And then when we did come home, to just continue not being able to, you know, put our best foot forward, and just really using that moment and not realizing at the time what feel it would be. But like you said, it definitely it was a moment to define us and myself as a, you know, really digging deep to, you know, figure out why we were here, you know, what we were doing, our purpose here, and just really finding ourselves in that. It was very tough.
Charlie?
Well, Jim, mine is a bad one and it's a good one. First of all, I was my freshman year here, you know, we do physicals. I found out that I had protein in my urine, which is a kidney disease, and that was a bad day. I thought I was going to die. I can still remember myself walking down Perrette Street all the way to from the doctor's office. And the good thing about it, I got my brother, who was the first black quarterback at Tulane. I got his kidney, and I've been having it for 20-some-odd years. So it turned out to be something great. So I got a good and a bad. That's me.
Steve?
I would answer. There are a number of moments, but I would pick the one that was I saw the most pain for my father, which was he knew he would never be able to be elected captain of his team. That was one of his things he wanted to do. He did everything academically, playing on the field, but it really hurt him. That was one of the many hurts, but this was the one that hurt him deeply, that I wanted to be a part of the team. I did everything, but I knew during that time period I would not be elected captain.
John Washington.
I think John's off.
John's gone. Harold. Sylvester.
Yeah, I am struggling. To come up with that answer. You know, I mean, there are a number of things that, you know, were problematic, but a worst moment. I'm really struggling. I can think of the time. The confusion, that was going on at that time, you know, was always in our face. My freshman year, and this is about, you know, turnarounds and politics and a lot of different things. But when I got to Tulane, one of the things that I did my father had been a naval in the Navy in World War II, that kind of stuff, and always fashion. That somehow.
Lost your audio? All right, I think we lost your audio.
Oh.
From the beginning? We got you back. You're back. We got you. We got you back.
Okay, great. So, my father, had been in the military, and I had a notion, that at some point was it might be a direction that I'd like to go in. And I actually tried to join Navy ROTC, and I got rejected. they said, because I had bad knees, they said. it wasn't about that at all. It was about my pigmentation. I understood that. But it forced me to come to terms with something. These folks, I guess they want me here because they actually invited me. I've got to put on blinders and go down a certain path, if I'm going to survive. At least maybe that's their expectation. That was hard to reconcile. Again, a great benefit, as it turns out, because 6 months later, my politics was so radically different. I'd have been the first AWOL person from Naval ROTC. It would have been a problem. But it's moments like that, that were problematic. And I think what it came down to is being on different terms, seeing life through a different prism, than even the entire Tulane University system was seeing life through. They were in discovery, as were we. We didn't know what the result of our new interaction was going to be.
Jim, would you repeat your question for John Washington, please?
Hey, John. The question was, what was your worst moment at Tulane? Trying to get at, those defining moments where you have to struggle through things to get through and make you what you are today. What was your most difficult moment?
Well, I can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I got this spinning icon, and I'm wondering if I could be heard. Mine is kind of like along the line with Charlie. And he probably don't remember this, but we played Florida State and got beat on a fifth down play. And we were upcoming young team then. And for them to beat us on a fifth down. Harold, you remember that?
Not specifically, but it sounds kind of familiar.
It was Miami.
Well, it was Miami. Okay. I said Florida State, but it was Miami. And I was the GOAT. I took the tight end inside and the back swung out, and rest is history. So it was a learning thing. But it was something that kind of molded my character. We had a chance to knock off a powerhouse, and I took the bait, followed the tight end, and swung the back out. And, of course, then, is that fifth down play. But it made me a little bit more – it was a downer as far as me as an athlete, but it also made me a better person because I learned from that mistake.
For those who don't know what John Washington is talking about the fifth down play, the officials lost track of the downs and gave Miami five downs to score instead of four. So that's what he's talking about. They got five downs to do it, yeah. So, all right.
Thank you.
Good question. Any other questions? Going once? Going twice? Going. Okay. We got to wrap it up, but you mentioned NIL. Somebody did.
Okay.
We did. Somebody did. Yeah. Okay. I'm a kid right now that's playing athletics here at Tulane or anywhere else here at Tulane, but specifically Tulane, because of what we're talking about today, and the people we're talking to today, and the people who were, for lack of a better word, the pioneers. And I'm the quarterback here, and I'm making $2 million. Okay? Or I'm getting $2 million, put it that way. Yeah. In view of what you went through, what would you tell me that I should do? What would you tell me about how I should navigate this, thinking in terms of what Steve and Harold and John and Charlie and Sharon went through? What do you think?
Well, I think it opens up a whole can of worms.
Sorry.
Yeah, I think we're about to go through a pretty dramatic change in college athletics. This NIL stuff. Yeah, first of all, women basketball players may be able to make more money staying in college than they can in the WNBA.
True.
And I just wonder if there's not a parallel, I mean, again, for all student athletes. There are other ways, besides the multi-million dollars that you make in the NFL. And that's not true for everybody. The top players are always going to get that, that exorbitant money. But for the average run-of-the-mill and the internet and stuff, what is the new reality, with the sports economy these days? So I think it needs a rethinking. And college kids need to be conscious of all the possibilities of NIL and other economic resources, period.
John Washington, what would you tell them in view of what people on this panel did?
Okay, and Sincere, I will probably direct that response mostly to you. As an old football player like Charlie and I, we got aches and pains. I've worn out both hips and just save your money. Don't spend it foolishly, because like the acronym for the NFL means not for long. So you really want to plan for the end, the ending time, because you don't want to play 5, 6, 7 years in the NFL and then spend your money foolishly, and then turn around being dead broke when you're 70 years old. So plan your money and hold on to it. Spend it wisely. Invest it wisely. And, then when you get as old as Harold and I and John and Charlie, you can always live off of some of that residual income.
Charlie Hall.
Well, first of all, let me say, when me and John play, we got $15 a month for laundry.
Y'all were rolling in the dough, huh?
Yeah, we really was. But, I don't know enough about it. I read a lot about it. All I know is if you're a cornerback, quarterback, running back, wide receiver, they the ones who are going to get the money. That's what I look at. But I think I'd be like John. If you're getting all that money like they say they're getting, I think it would be wise for you to invest your money, because if you don't go to the next level after you leave college and you go into the pros and you don't make it, then if you don't have anything, then you're just back as where you were before. But I would definitely advise that you get a financial planner, somebody who could help you and tell you about where your money needs to be invested at, so that you can have something and you can live off of something. Because, in this world today, everything has gone up, bro, since 1970, since 2000. So you need to be, as a young man, a young lady, and whatever that is, basketball, you need to be able to have some type of financial support to get you started. And I learned one thing once I've been married. This might sound kind of crazy. You got to have credit. As my wife is an accountant, retired accountant, she said, if you don't have credit, you can't get nothing. So I would definitely say that's what you need to do.
Charlie Hall may not have been a quarterback or a running back or a wide receiver, but he would have got money, okay? Stephen, what would your father tell them in view of what you guys did?
Two things he would have said. One is, which is a decision at that time period, is get your degree. And if you get your degree, he would have said, get your terminal degree. And what he meant by that was whatever field you go into, whether it was if you choose medicine, you were the terminal degree, one would say is getting an MD or OD, or DL, excuse me. Or if you go into engineering, you get a master's so that you don't need to come back. You finish it. And so those would be the two things he would probably share with student athletes as they're going time. Because to your point, you have a limited 3-5 years typically. I don't know what the average is for an NFL player, along with your money and investing, to make sure that you understand what those investments mean and how you can impact your community. And so that's what he would share.
Okay. It looks like Carlin wants to wrap it up. I want to say thank you to John Washington.
Give me one second.
Okay.
So we did have one question on the line, okay. So we want to go ahead and knock that out before we get out of here.
Okay.
So we had a young lady, Chloe, asked, and this is directed at Dr. Steve Martin with his terminal degree. She wanted to know, St. Aug held the other scholarships from your dad. So she wanted to know if you could explain why he felt that St. Aug held those scholarships back from him from the other universities to kind of direct him to Tulane. And then after that, we're going to
close it up. That has to be a quick answer or response, simply because that's another documentary. It involves the Josephite order priests. It involves the particular principal at that time, Father Robert Grant, who at that time was spearheading the integration of high school athletics in Louisiana, as well as integration of academics institutions across the country. He felt that St. Augustine was producing the creme de la creme and wanted to place them strategically at Harvard and Yale and all these institutions, but he hadn't gotten to Tulane. So his first was Reynolds, then came he saw my dad in the cafeteria and said, this will be my next project. And here he is at Tulane. For good or bad reasons, Father Grant held back those letters. My father found out particularly about Michigan State because I believe it was a classmate that came up to him and said, hey, the coach of Michigan State, this was a year after they won the national championship, mentioned you're in the newspaper. The coach mentions your name in the newspaper, talking about my dad. And so there was intention and reasoning why that was held back. I was simply in on a high note. Which is, and I think for my siblings and for my mother, that had he not gone to Tulane, we would not be here. He could have took a left turn, and the story could be very different for Tulane as well as for our family. Mm-hmm. So here we are.
Yeah, and, you know, in closing, yeah, what Steve says is correct. I mean, a lot of it was intentional. If you go through the civil rights movement, you know, I mean, you know, there's a reason why it was Rosa Parks. You know, Homer Plessy was planned, okay? He got there to be arrested, and he was the guy that they picked to do it. And it's the same kind of thing. You know, that was done a lot. That's, you know, you want to make sure you had the right person. And although I know it was really painful, Steve, because I talked to him about it a little bit, to your father, yeah, I know it was rough, it was painful. The fact of the matter is, they got the right guy. He was the right guy. As hard as it was for him, he was the right guy.
There's no question about that.
I mean, there was,
you know, A.P. Turo Jr., of course, you know, he was the first at LSU, and he told his daddy, I can't do it. He came back to Xavier. So, you know, he was the right guy. I'd say that. Charlie Hall.
Thank you.
Sincere Haynesworth.
Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Martin. John Washington. Sharon Hill. Harold Sylvester. Important people, important people. This has been navigating the muddy waters from Steve Martin to the Cotton Bowl. And we need to thank, you know, Carmen Jones and Jim Becknell.
Jim Becknell.
And all those people back there, Justin and all them, take y'all bow.
And yep,
Journey
Justin.
And Justin. Yep. Thank you. Congratulations. Audiovisual people, the whole works. Thank y'all.
Thanks,
hoping
everybody.
To make it hard for you. Thank you.